commencing at the 7th verse. And the Lord appeared unto Abram and said unto thy seed, I will give this land. And there builded he an altar unto the Lord, who appeared unto him. And he removed from thence unto a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west, and Hai on the east. And there he builded an altar unto the Lord, and called upon the name of the Lord. And Abram journeyed, going on still toward the south. And there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down into Egypt to sojourn there, where for the famine was grievous in the land. And then we're commencing at the beginning of the 13th chapter. And Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the south. And Abram was very rich in cattle, in silver and in gold. And he went on his journeys from the south, even to Bethel, unto the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Hai, unto the place of the altar which he had made there at the first. And there Abram called on the name of the Lord. Let's pray. Dear friends, we find the children of Israel still at Sinai. And we recall that in our last lesson, that God, in giving instructions to Moses, commanded him to speak to the children of Israel. And we suggested at that time the fact that God changed his manner of speaking to the children of Israel probably was intended to indicate that not only was there an antitypical significance in the millennial age for the picture they're concerned, but that there was one with which we were most definitely identified. In other words, when God had instructions to give to the priesthood, God would say to Moses, command Aaron and his sons. Aaron and his sons, of course, were the representatives of Jehovah God. And since they represented him, and everything they said and did would be therefore to glorify his name, they could not undertake to do anything which would be contrary to his will. And so, being that they were consecrated and dedicated to him to do his service, to do his peculiar treasure in a special sense, he could command them to do as he instructed. Now, of course, it is clear that the antithetical priesthood of God, that he has a right to command us, because we too, like unto that priesthood of old, have been consecrated and dedicated to him. We have no right to express our own will. We must ever and always glorify God before the people. And you remember that at that time we brought to your attention the fact that there was a leprosy which the priest, of course, would declare, and the congregation was responsible for placing the leper without the camp. We brought to your attention at that time those symptoms which would appear, which would not necessarily imply that there was a leprosy. It would be, however, up to the priest to determine. After examination, and he was not to be hasty in judging the matter. If he wasn't too sure about it, the individual would have to be set apart for 7 days and then re-examined. And if then he could not yet come to a definite decision in the matter, he was again to set him apart. And what a beautiful lesson this is, dear friends, for you and for me. I sometimes like to think of it that the new creature is the priest, and that the old man that we have to deal with is the one that bears the symptoms of leprosy. And there might be the danger on our part sometimes to deal too harshly in judgment of ourselves, though we often do that with others. But sometimes, even with ourselves, we could be too harsh. The Apostle Paul undoubtedly had this in mind when he declared that he wouldn't even judge himself. He knew that there was one who would judge him, and he would be given a righteous judgment. that we brought to your attention that these symptoms were a swelling in the skin. Well, now, of course, there are many things that could correspond to that with you and with me. Selfishness, egotism, conceit, all of these things would manifest themselves as a swelling. But you recognize, dear friends, that some of these traits of the old man are the result of the fall 6,000 years ago. And God, knowing this, has made allowances for these. They are covered by the sacrifice of Jesus. His blood shed on Calvary's cross covers those sins. But you see, dear friends, there are some of these sins which manifest themselves, which are the result of partial willfulness. Not entire willfulness, but partial willfulness, because if it was absolute and complete, then certainly we would have no right to any of the further grace and the favor of God. We would be guilty of the sin unto death. The secret sin having become a sin against the Holy Spirit through the presumption which would mark us in saying that God knows our frame, that we are but dust, and therefore we feel that since God knows our frame and that we are but dust, we could ignore the secret thought and let it become the presumptuous sin, and we become in turn guilty of the great transgression. So the priest, as he looked down upon the swelling in the flesh, was to know whether it was deeper than the skin. And that certainly is an indication, we believe, that in this symbolism it was intended to show for us that there are some things which are on the surface which God can look at, but there are some things that lie deeper than the surface and which originate in the heart. And therefore, they must be judged. And in the camp of Israel, leprosy was not a type of sin, but it was sin. And so with but one exception, we find that whenever leprosy is dealt with, it is cleansed, not healed. And so is it with you and with me. Spiritual leprosy is not a type of sin, it is sin. And we do not need to be healed from it, but cleansed of it. And then you will remember too, dear friends, that another symptom was that the raw flesh appeared, and how easy it is for the raw flesh to appear as we deal with one another, as we deal with people in the world sometimes. Or we think that they're people of the world and they're not of the congregation. And so, of course, nobody in the congregation knows anything about it. And we can just let out a little bit, just as we feel. But you know, as the poet says, think not because no man sees such things remain unseen. So you see, dear friends, the judge, the priest, the new mind in Christ Jesus must judge these things of the flesh and make no allowances. Because to have such in the camp of Israel was defiling the dwelling place of God. Now, we've merely reviewed this briefly, dear friends, because we have quite a marked contrast between the lesson that we had a week ago, I should say 2 weeks ago, in connection with leprosy, and the lesson of today. The leper was undoubtedly on the lowest plane of degradation. His disease was loathsome. On the other hand, the man that we are to consider today is at the acme. He's the height. He's the uppermost. He's the Nazarite of God. He is a symbol of purity and holiness. And so when God would speak now to the children of Israel, it's not a piece of command, because in this matter, which of course has an application also in the millennium, but also for you and for me, because the Apostle Paul would declare those things which happened to Israel happened to them for types, but they record it for us, for our admonition. So we're going to draw whatever lessons we can from it, because God is a great economist, and he's given no pictures that do not have sufficient purpose. Some of them concern the world in the millennium. Some of them concern the church here and now. All the wilderness wanderings will be more or less duplicated by the world during the millennium as they go marching onward toward the promised kingdom of rest to be attained at the end of the millennial age. But surely all of these experiences of natural Israel, the Israel according to the flesh, are profitable for our meditation, because from these we learn lessons which are very important for us to learn. And so God says in this instance, note the contrast, it's not men, but it says, speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them, when either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow of a Nazarite, to separate themselves unto the Lord. Now notice, dear friends, this is not something that is compulsory. No one is urged or coerced. This is when a person will, if he will, if he desires to consecrate and dedicate himself to God, he may do this. But we'd like you to know, dear friends, now this is a very sharp picture, a very strong picture, because it shows that consecration is its own reward. That the consecration isn't for something that is to be attained, but rather an appreciation of something already received. And I believe the tabernacle types also prove this, because one coming in through the gate must first recognize the altar of sacrifice, and then he can make no progress towards the door of the tabernacle unless he has first recognized the labor. And having recognized the labor, he may then proceed to the door of the tabernacle. So it is required that we be faithful to that which has already been given to us, that we appreciate what we have before God will give us any more. If we don't appreciate it, well, you see why it is. If you study God's word and you let him say you feel you want more, you'll start to dig and you'll study and you'll get more of a blessing. But if you don't appreciate it, you're manifested in your indifference. Well, it doesn't make any difference whether you read it or not. You can let it go for tomorrow or the next day, or you might find a magazine or throw the radio or something else to listen to. Well, if that is the case, you'll find that proportionately you're going to lose, because you have not appreciated what you have. And Jesus put it this way, to him who had shall be given, but from him who had not, even that which he had shall be taken. So you see, dear friends, in this particular instance, it says that either a man or a woman would separate himself to vow of a Nazarite, there is nothing that is promised as a reward for faithfulness. But the faith is carried out the vow as it was made. Acceptably, one would suffer. He would suffer reverses. He would suffer hardships. He would suffer because he would lose everything that he had before. And if he were committed to start over again, he would have to start over afresh from the very beginning. But I want you to think that in this particular instance, it wasn't like the consecration of the priesthood, because only the sons of Aaron were invited to this. But we would like you to know that this is man or woman. And therefore, this is the most beautiful picture, we think, because it encompasses so much. It isn't only in the sense that a man may consecrate, but womankind as well. And you will see the beauty of this picture as we progress with it. And it says, speak to the children and say unto them, when either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a Nazarite, to separate themselves unto the Lord,
shall drink no vinegar of wine or vinegar of strong drink, neither shall he drink any liquor of grapes nor eat moist grapes or dried. All the days of his separation shall he eat nothing that is made of the vine tree from the pillars even to the house. Now notice, dear friends, what a great distance God puts between the Nazarite and the non-Nazarite, between the one who consecrates himself and sets himself apart to the Lord and the one who does not. In other words, there is no faith line of demarcation. They're so far apart that they could never be confused. And so in the matter of your consecration to the Lord, if you're consecrating yourself to Him, or have done so, you will find that there has to be such a wide difference between what you would be if you were living in the world among the people and what you are as the consecrated saint of God. In other words, there's a wide difference, a big space in between of wine, but what is wine is the fruit of the vine. And of course, dear friends, we recognize that the vine itself could be a beautiful picture. But in this regard, we've got to be guided by the little fingers, the little signposts along the road, which tell us how we are to apply the pictures. Now, another instance like this, dear friends, we find in the tabernacle too. You remember there in one place where the children of Israel, not the children of Israel, but the sons of Aaron, Aaron's sons, lay their hands upon the head of the bull. And there it signifies it represents us. But there came a time when Aaron put his hands upon the head of a living goat. And that did not represent this, represents us. Something had changed. And you've got to watch for the little signpost along the line, else you're going to find yourself in trouble. If you're going to take Moses as the great deliverer of the children of Israel, as a type of Christ, and think that you can carry that picture on indefinitely, you'll find yourself much mistaken, because the time comes when Moses smites the rock a second time and becomes a picture or a symbol of Moses that is greater the second death. So you've got to watch the signposts. You've got to watch the changes in the route. Sometimes it doesn't run straight ahead. Sometimes there's a left turn or a right turn. And sometimes it almost goes back on itself before it goes forward again. And so we say here, we've got to be careful in using these various symbols for the purposes that we have in mind. But you notice, dear friends, that the wine has been used as a symbol of joy, but it's an earthly joy. In other words, in most instances, it has tended to voluptuousness. In other words, a looseness, a desire for earthly pleasures, and the things that the world can give. It does this by way of an exhilaration, by way of making people very warm within. They become very sociable, and they talk a lot. You find with a man that has given himself to indulging of spiritus liquor, the very first thing he does, he becomes very sociable. He's willing to put his arms around everybody that comes along. It doesn't make any difference who it is. It might have been their worst enemies before. But under the influence of the alcohol, when he says, we're all brothers. And so he goes on. Now, dear friends, this has its spiritual counterpart. If we imbibe of a worldly spirit, and you don't have to go into the world to imbibe a worldly spirit, you can imbibe a worldly spirit even in the church among so-called truth peoples. Now, we may say this in passing. We have no particular individual in mind. But we may feel that we've got to give you the whole counsel of God, that we can't hold back anything. We know when the time will come when we will need to put into practice the lessons that you have learned from God's Word. And suppose one had refused to set forth the whole counsel of God before particular thing in mind. No, only because you're endeavoring to bring to your attention certain features and phases of God's plan that have to do with your spiritual development and in your consecrated attitude toward God. And so we find, my dear friends, as we partake of the Holy Spirit that makes us very sensible, and I say you can find it in the church. There are those who in the church have partaken of the Holy Spirit. And it doesn't make very, very much difference what you believe, just so long as you have fellowship. There was a brother that came to our home some years ago, and he came over from England. And he spent a few moments with us, and he says, well, I'm not interested in what you believe. It's just service, service. That's the important thing. You've got to serve the Lord. Who are you that you're taking my words into your mouth, seeing that you do not heed instructions that come from me? Well, that's what the Lord says, you see. So there is the danger, dear friends, of allowing ourselves to become rash and indifferent. Not that we could forsake the assemblies of ourselves together. That is very, very important, particularly as we see the day approaching. But we should be very, very careful about our fellowship, that we do not just take in too much of the liberal spirit, the worldly spirit. And the result is that after one has partaken of this worldly spirit, he becomes very talkative. Well, of course, you have to talk to everybody then. You've got a new idea. This is something that you've never seen before. And you think, well, maybe Bill Russell, if he were living today, he'd have the same idea. Well, that's the way you feel about it, because you've got some spirit within you that is not the spirit of the Lord. And so you become very talkative. You become very sociable. And you know you imbibe still more of the Spirit. And what is the result? Well, after a while, you know, your vision is no longer clear. You see two or three objects, and you try to close one eye and close the other to see whether there are one, two, or three before you. Well, dear friends, what happened? The result of taking in the Spirit has made it impossible for you to judge truth from error, holy from unholy. You're in the place where you would compromise for peace's sake. Well, you know, dear friends, then the speech becomes inarticulate. And what I mean by that, you say a lot of things, but they don't mean anything. They might mean something to you because you're under the Spirit. You don't know what you're even saying. But as you speak, anybody with a sound mind that listens to you will recognize that you were drunk, that you have partaken of the worldly spirit. You have taken it in. The other things you see, it's simple enough to consider perhaps as to what these wines, this strong drink might be. It might be easy for you to judge just what that would be. But you notice, dear friends, that the Lord wasn't satisfied to leave it just with that. Because, he says, not only shall we be separated from wine and strong drink, and shall drink the vinegar of wine or vinegar of strong drink, neither any drink or any liquor of grapes, nor shall we eat moist grapes or dried. Well, did you ever see anybody that drunk from eating a raisin? Of course you didn't. Well, what is it? It's a dried grape, isn't it? And why do you suppose that God was so careful about the manner that he wouldn't even let the man who might eat a moist grape or a dried one? Just because he wanted to make sure that they wouldn't get so close together that they wouldn't know the difference between one and the other. If you're a consecrated child of God, the difference must be so great that people will not be mistaken as they look upon you, because there will be something there to indicate that you are different. And, dear friends, the kernels or even the husks, all the days of the separation shall eat nothing that is made of the vine tree, from the kernels even to the husks. Now, dear friends, there is a sense in which we might recognize that Adam was the representative of the whole human race. In his original creation, he was pure, he was holy. He was harmless. He was undefiled. There was no sin in the world as yet. He was in the same position as one who is in covenant relationship with God. And the Nazarite was in just such a position. But Adam did partake of the vine of the earth. And as a result of it, what happened? The days of his consecration, the days of that blessedness which were before his sinning, were all allowed to him. And not until the seventh day, as we shall see as we proceed, will he be able to cleanse himself from the defilement. And then, dear friends, aside from that, not until the eighth day will he be able to rededicate and reconsecrate. Now that in itself is a picture. We're not saying it's a type. It's a simile. But let no one mistake, we're not referring to it as a type. And that's where the danger lies sometimes, in calling everything that we see a type. Sometimes they're merely similes, merely pictures, metaphors, and the like. Now, we notice then, dear friends, insofar as the saints of God are concerned, there is an application to us here and now. That's the your condition in which we find ourselves as a result of sin. And certainly one who has come through the gate into the court is still a sinner. He's tentatively justified. He hasn't reached the point where he is vitalizably justified. But he's coming in the right direction. And for him, the seventh day is the day when he can consecrate and dedicate himself through the cleansing made possible by coming to the fountain of blood which Jesus has provided. That's the moment when you consecrate. Immediately after that is for you an eighth day. It's the day when you can consecrate and dedicate. And you remember that it was the eighth day in the time when the little Hebrew boy was circumcised. The symbol was the cutting off of the flesh on the eighth day. Certainly, that's a beautiful picture of our own consecration, where there must be the cutting off of the flesh, the cutting off of all that pertains to the world and worldly things. And so we see, dear friends, there are some things which in themselves would not be wrong for you to eat grapes, raisins, things like that. What's wrong about that? Nothing. But if you were to partake of spirituous liquor, and as a result of that become unbalanced, or lose your sense of perspective through clouded vision, and eventually fall into a stupor, you see there is a big difference. You probably wouldn't reach that state by eating the grape, or the dry grape, or the kernel, or merely the husk. But nevertheless, there are things which would be legitimate and proper for you if you were in the world. But as a Nazarite of God, you can't do these things because God has put so much space between you and the world that if you engage in these worldly pursuits, you're in danger of marring that consecration which should exist between you and your God, and it is his consecration that is upon your head. Now, Dr. Lightfoot, who lived about 100 years ago, and he was one of the great theologians of the time, he suggests that the fruit in the garden of which Adam and Eve partook was of the vine. Now, of course, whether it was or not, we surely don't know. And we might almost be tempted to say, well, the juice of the grape did not ferment until after the flood. So there probably wouldn't have been anything that even created any physical disturbance in his partaking of it. But there was that disobedience to God. That's the important thing. That was the sin. It wasn't merely the participation of some natural earthly fruit, but it was the disobedience to the will of God that worked out for him the punishment which was in due time meted out upon him. Now, it says here, dear friends, all the days of the vow of the separation there shall no razor come upon his head until the day be fulfilled in which he separated himself unto the Lord. He shall be holy and shall let the locks of the hair of his head grow. Now, we'd like you to note that, dear friends. This is very, very peculiar. Because here is an instance where hair is a symbol, and it's a symbol of spiritual strength. Sometimes hair is the symbol of a fleshly growth. In connection with the consecration of the Levites, you will remember that they were to use the razor and shave off the hair from their bodies. That, of course, was a symbol. In our consecration, we have to cut off from ourselves everything that is in the nature of a fleshly growth. By that I mean in a spiritual sense, of course. But in this particular symbolism that we have here, this hair represents the covenant which subsists between God and the Nazarite. And that covenant vouches to the individual strength, spiritual strength. So long as you are in covenant relationship with God, it isn't the covenant itself, but it's the relationship which exists which gives you the strength, the Spirit of God dwelling within you. So that the covenant itself is merely the symbol of the Spirit itself. Now, what we mean by that, dear friends, is this. That the Nazarite was to let the locks of his head grow. The locks of his hair no longer represent the outgrowth of the flesh, but they represented spiritual strength. And as time went on, the hair grew, which of course meant there was an increase of spiritual strength, of fortitude that moved along with it. But the hair being long was an indication to everyone that would see the Nazarite that he was a Nazarite. It would distinguish him from all other people. It would represent that he was subject to the will of the Father, that he was entirely dedicated to Jehovah's blessed will. Now, here's something that we'd like you to know. A woman wears a hair long, as if it were a symbol of her consecration, her dedication, her fidelity, her loyalty to the one man who is her husband. And we have there the picture which the Apostle Paul also gives, where he says, I speak of Christ and the church. So each and every one of us as an Israelite would be like the bride of Christ, the woman who wearing her hair long indicates her subjection to the will of her husband, which will is the will of God. Now, dear friends, let's not misunderstand here. A husband's will is not always the expression of the will of God. It can be otherwise. It has been otherwise all times. But we're speaking about that which is according to the will and purpose of God, as it should be, not as it oft times is. And so we have here a beautiful picture the locks, the long hair, are what distinguish you. Your spiritual strength, your ability to stand before people and be different from them. You can imagine what they would say, you who are men, if you had long hair and you went walking through the streets with long hair. They'd say, look at the sister, look at that fellow. They'd all play on, wouldn't they? Wouldn't they play on, wouldn't they? Now, spiritually speaking, that's the reason you and I wear our hair long, as Nazarites of God. In other words, to say, look at that fellow. In other words, they find in us no comeliness, no beauty that they might desire any more than they did in Jesus, who came to his own and theirs we did not. And so you see, dear friends, what a beautiful symbolism we have here. Now, you will note, dear friends, that in connection with the first prohibition for the Nazarite, he was not to take round a strong drink. Now, no one can really make you drink. If you want a drink, you take what is outside. You pour it into your mouth and you take it inside. You've brought that which is on the outside in, and you've done it by a deliberate act of your own. That certainly, to me, dear friends, would be a picture of the second act. Bringing in an outside spirit that would so confuse and distort the truth within my own heart that I could no longer feel that God could have a dwelling place in here. In other words, I became so worldly, so fleshly, that I could no longer feel that God could dwell within my heart. But on the other hand, who is there that is a Nazarite that would cut his own hair when he knew that that was the symbol of his relationship to God? Certainly no Nazarite would cut his own hair. So you see, dear friends, the danger here is not that we will cut our own hair. The danger lies elsewhere. The danger lies in our loving unwisely and placing our heads in the lap of a Delilah only to have her have the Philistines come along and cut off the locks of our hair. Now, dear friends, what do we mean by that? Well, Delilah can represent a number of things. It could represent Christianity or churchianity. It could represent that. But it represents something far deeper for you and for me. It wasn't wrong, perhaps, for him to love Delilah, except that I know he wasn't condemned for it. Nor does it anywhere say that Samson came short of fulfilling the vow of the Nazarite. He kept it even to death. And Brother Russell says that too. In other words, it wasn't willfulness that caused the locks of his head to be cut, but carelessness and indifference. He loved Delilah. She said she loved him too. But did she? We know there are a lot of people who love you for what they can get out of you. They love you for what you're able to give them. If you've got money, you've got friends. But when you don't have any money, you look around for your friends, and they're all on the other side of the street, walking the other way. Do you know that's just it, dear friends? Who is my neighbor? And so Delilah, she said to Samson, you don't love me. And the poor body loved her, that he told the secret of his heart. Now you see, dear friends, what isn't that the test that comes today, more or less? People say you don't love us. And to prove that you love us, you've got to go where we go. And if you don't go where we go, why, you don't love us. You have friends, you have relatives. They say, well, so-and-so's graduating, we'd like you to come along and be present at the graduation. You say, well, I have a meeting tonight, and I don't want to miss this meeting tonight. It means more to me than this graduation, but I'll be very, very glad to send you a little gift or something, a token of my esteem and all this and that, and you don't love it. If you did, you'd come along and go where he goes. And so you let the bars down just a little bit. You go where they go. And what is the result of it? After a while, you develop a taste for what they kind of like. There's nothing wrong. The Bible doesn't say you shouldn't do this. The Bible doesn't say you shouldn't drink. The Bible doesn't say you shouldn't smoke. The Bible doesn't say you shouldn't dance. The Bible doesn't say you shouldn't go to the movies. It doesn't say any of those things. Well, that's where the distance comes in between the Nazarite and the man of the world. He who is consecrated and dedicated to God, he can't take the moist spirit of God. There isn't anything actually wrong with it. But it's contrary to the spirit of our consecration. And therefore, it will work for ill with us. So we see there, friends, how sharp these pictures of times are. Now, taking it in a spiritual light. Let's assume now that there were some friends that wanted you to meet with them. Who say they wanted you to meet with them in convention? Now, we don't have anyone in particular in mind. This is just hypothetical, you know, dear friends. But nobody says they'll apply a claim with somebody, but they're not. We're just giving a hypothetical instance. Well, we love all that love the Lord. Naturally, we do that. We want it to be so. Regardless of what they believe, we love them all. But we love them in different degrees. Now, some of these friends say, well, now you come over and meet with us. We'd be glad to have you meet with us. And we meet with them. And what is the result? Well, they don't believe in the sin offering. They don't believe the church is shared in the sin offering. Well, after you've met with them for a little while, you begin to say, well, that isn't too important. After all, the important thing is fellowship. That we fellowship one another, that we come together, and we forsake not the assembly of ourselves together. Well, the first thing you know, you fall asleep. You're perfectly content to be there, you know. And they're happy to have you there. And before you know it, the locks of your head and cup, a doctrine which was once so important to you, and not so much in connection with your spiritual vitality and your consecration, has been taken from you. And you get up and you shake yourself like Samson did it all the time, and your strength is gone. It's promiscuous fellowship, dear friends. Now, again, we remind you, we're not talking about any particular group or any particular denominational sect or individual. This is just hypothetical. It's just a picture, and you might make the application. We're not making it for you. We're giving you the picture for whatever it may be to you. So be careful that the locks of your hair are not cut. You're not going to cut them, no. That you might, through carelessness or indifference, put yourself in such a compromising position that someone else cuts your hair off for you. And the result is that when you would be strong, you're going to be weak because you have lost that relationship which once existed. And so you see, dear friends, how important it is that we as spiritual Nazarites see to it that no razor ever comes nigh to our locks. Now, the third prohibition here, dear friends, and we've got to hold on because we see the time going very, very rapidly. It says, all the days that he separated himself unto the Lord, he shall come up no dead body. He shall not make himself unclean for his father, or for his mother, for his brother, or for his sister, and then no die. Because the consecration of his God is upon his head. All the days of his separation, he is holy unto the Lord. Now certainly, that is something that applies to those who are the spiritual seed. You remember that in this connection, dear friends, there is something similar to this said in connection with the priesthood, that they could not defile themselves for the dead either. And so we find much that is parallel here with the typical priesthood. And we're not at all surprised, because they who are represented in the picture of the Nazarite are the same ones that are represented in the picture of the priesthood. Now you see, dear friends, they are defiled by contact with death. Now actually, dear friends, if we examine the picture very carefully, we find that for the one who drinks the wine or strong drink, there is no opportunity given for him to start afresh in the night of his consecration. He's lost out completely. So what is it with the one who commits the sin unto death? He's out of the race entirely. But the second one, who through carelessness or indifference allows the lust of his head to be cut, certainly he is not as guilty as the one who deliberately took wine or strong drink and violated the spirit of his bride. But there is no opportunity for him to commence again either. And we say here, friends, now the first is a picture of those that go into the second death. The second is a picture of those who, through indifference or carelessness, fail to attain the full reward. In other words, they represent the great company. So you see, not neither the second aircraft nor the great company, according to this picture, can start over again. They've lost. But for the one who has become defiled through contact with death, there is an opportunity. Why? Because he could not very well avoid that. He may be at home with his family. And if one of his family should die in the house, he would be defiled by the death of that one in the house. You know, dear friends, if you met someone on the street and you've been in the house where someone died, if you shook hands and greeted them in that way, one would be defiled too, and that's the way the defilement would spread. There certainly wouldn't be a thing that you yourself would want to do to come in contact with death. As far as you're concerned, what would you have to do in order not to be guilty of contact with death? Well, you'd have to walk by yourself. You'd have to sleep by yourself. Anything that you did would have to be just alone with death. And actually, that's what it calls for in the matter of your consecration. You can't lean on anybody else. Because if you lean on some brother or sister, you know they could die, spiritually speaking. And if they died, and you had to lean on so heavily upon them, what would happen to you? You'd be defiled thereby. You might be able to start over again. But all the period that you had before that time would be lost. You'd have to start over from scratch, as it were. You remember that portion that we read before the meeting started today? We read to you about Abraham. How after he had left all of the Chaldees, he came into the land of Canaan. And he built an altar of Bethel. But there was a famine in the land. And so Abraham, without asking God, his friend, as to what he should do under the circumstances, went down into Egypt. If you remember down there in Egypt, he came into some serious trouble on account of Sarah, his wife. And so he started back to Canaan. And you know where he had to go? Back to Bethel, the place where he made his little turn, where he deviated from the course. That's where he had to fight. All that was before had been lost. He might have been in the land of Canaan, might now have been established in that land. But now we had to start over as it were afresh. And so there is this defilement which comes by contact with death. But dear friends, there isn't one of us that does not come in contact with death because we have this old man, this body of corruption, which we are all the time, well, it's chained to us. And as we walk through the streets, it leaves out an awful stench. The people just believe in what's left of that. If we weren't dead, you see, if we didn't have that dead man there, it wouldn't be so bad, but it's because of the stench of creation in our nostrils. What do I mean by that? I mean, dear friends, if you're living the Christ life, then you're dead to your own will. You're alive to the will of God. And because you're dead to your own will, it's so repugnant to the spirit of the world, so repugnant to the world, the flesh, and the devil, that your life is a veritable stench. They say, well, we'll be glad when you're all out of this world. We need a little change here anyhow. And so we don't care very much about us being in your midst. But it's all because of the factual things that this contact is done. Now you see, that is a contact that you now can't avoid. And so every now and then, the old man, you come in contact with the old man in our own flesh. That's the reason that you and I have to continually rededicate ourselves from day to day. You can't rely on the consecration that you made 5, 10, 15, or 20 years ago and say, well, that still holds. It may still hold, yes. But undoubtedly, as you examine yourself and see how far short you have come along the way, you see how necessary it is for you to reconcentrate and rededicate yourself to the task that still remains unfinished and unaccomplished. And now, dear friends, that clock is just a few minutes past, so don't take that one too serious, but there is just one little thought that we would like to get into it, and that is, it says here, and if any man dies or is kept revive him, and he hath defiled the head of his consecration, then he shall shave his head in the day of his cleansing, and on the seventh day shall he shave it, and on the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves, two young pigeons, to the priest, to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and the priest shall offer the one for a sin offering, the other for a burnt offering, and make an atonement for him, for that he sinned by the dead, and shall hallow his head that same day. Now you see, that's the one who has come in contact with death. Not the one that has taken the wine or strong drink. Not the one whose eyes of his head have been cut because of indifference or carelessness or for having fallen asleep when he should have been alert and wide awake. No, there's no opportunity for them. But for the true saint of God, who cannot avoid coming in contact with his own flesh continually, God has made provision. And in the sacrifice of Christ and in his merit, the one who died and who rose again, the one who died to make atonement, and the one who ever lived to make intercession. I think, dear friends, we're merely suggesting that in these two turtle doves there, one is killed as a sin offering, and the other is let go, or one becomes a burnt offering. Well, at any rate, we find here, dear friends, and he shall consecrate unto the Lord the days of the separation, and shall bring a lamb of the first year for a trespass offering, but the days that were before shall be lost, because the separation was defiled. But this is the law of the Nazarite. When the days of the separation are fulfilled, and he shall be brought unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and he shall offer his offering unto the Lord. One he lamb of the first year without blemish for a burnt offering, one she lamb of the first year without blemish for a sin offering, and one lamb without blemish for a peace offering. And there'll be a basket of unleavened bread, cakes of fine flour mingled with oil, and wafers of unleavened bread anointed with oil, and their meat offering and their drink offerings. You see, there's something that runs parallel here to the consecration of the priest. Then it says, the Nazarite shall shave the head of his separation at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and shall take the hair of the head of his separation, and put it on the fire which is under the sacrifice of the peace offerings, and the priest shall take the solemn shoulder of the ram, and one unleavened cake, and one and the basket, and out of the basket of the unleavened bread, and unleavened wafers, and shall put them upon the hands of the Nazarite, after the hair of the separation of Stephen, and the priest shall wave them for a wave offering before the Lord. This is holy for the priest, with the raised breast and the deep shoulder. And after that, the Nazarite may drink wine. Now, it's just in connection with that last, we don't have time to dwell on all that that goes in between. But you see, there comes a time when he shaves off the hairs of his head. They're not sure that after this instance because of defilement, for now he has fulfilled. His consecration is full and complete. The hair which represents that consecration is shaven off, is laid upon the altar, and brought under the priest offering, and then the Nazarite may drink. Well, dear friends, I think that is something which is implied in the words of Jesus. If there ever was a Nazarite, it was Jesus, not according to the flesh, because undoubtedly Jesus did drink wine.
That's why they called him a wine bibber. But on the other hand, you remember that Jesus also came in contact with death. He raised the dead. He healed the sick. Like a dead body of the dead, he was continually coming in contact with them. So that according to the letter of the law, he was no Nazarite. But if there ever was a Nazarite, Jesus was this Nazarite. And just before he reached Calvary's cross, he takes the hairs of his head, shaves them off, lays them under the sacrifice, and on the occasion of the celebration with his disciples in the upper room, he says, "With desire have I desired to eat this Passover with you. But I shall not again drink of this vine of the earth till I drink it with you and you in the kingdom." And so there comes this, where the Nazarite drinks wine, it'll be the wine of joy. After he has completed his consecration, after he has been faithful, figuratively unto death, so in the spirit, the true Nazarite of God, there comes a time when his consecration has been fully completed, that he may then drink wine, and he will drink it anew with the Lord in the kingdom. We trust, dear friends, that you may have been able to get some blessing out of that, if not, at least something to give you a reason for self-examination.